Moncrief on News Talk.
Afternoon, Joanna Fortune.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Right, here's your first question. My 9-year-old recently heard of an attempted kidnapping in our area. Don't know the facts of this, but he is really, really worried and anxious about this ever since. He would be anxious at times, but really not sure what to do about this, as he's really worried. This is going on for a week now.
Oh, do you know, it's that age, isn't it, when they become more aware of dangers in the world outside of them, but also interwoven is, in that middle childhood, is actually parents don't have the answer to everything. There are some things our parents can't prevent or can't help. So actually, when I worry, I tend to worry at that louder, bigger level, and something as dramatic as this. And sometimes these stories about attempted kidnappings, yes, they absolutely have roots that there's something suspicious has happened. But then even between peers this age, the story can grow legs and add on details in a snowballing way. I think, though, as one of the mistakes we tend to make as parents in an attempt to make things better for our kids is that we move too quickly to reassure them when they're worried about something. And inadvertently, we minimize or dismiss the worry and say, oh, you don't need to worry about that, or that's not something to be concerned about. That would never happen to you. And it's coming from a good place of, I don't want them worried about it. But actually, the message it sends a worrying child is, I shouldn't bring this worry to you. And now I'm going to sit on it and percolate with it, or maybe talk about it with my, you know, not so wise, but assuming themselves to be very wise friends, and we'll try and work it out ourselves. So actually, we need to create space for these worries to be shared with us and heard by us. So I think approach this through the lens of acceptance and empathy. You know, let him know that you've heard it by inviting him to tell you the story he's telling himself. So don't get too caught up from the outset in what's a fact and what's not a fact. Just let him tell you the story that he's running through his own head at the moment.
Yeah.
Then reflect back to him what you're hearing, but with empathy, going, you know, oh my goodness, that's really scary. I think if that was something I was thinking about, I would feel exactly like you do. I'd be really worried about it too. That makes sense that you're worrying about this. But then wonder about a safety plan. Okay, you're worried it would happen to you. Let's think. Allow him to think the worst so that you can break it down into solutions and question some of that absolute thinking with, okay, but remember, I always pick you up at school, so I meet you at the gate. You wouldn't meet anyone beyond the gate because I'd be there, or whatever it might be, for example, that you can challenge some of the myth belief with some facts. And just let him think through solutions and who's available to him. If a stranger approached you, what would you do? What could you do? What should you do in this situation, so that he feels he has a plan in place that will give him that reassurance, but from the inside out? Of course, you're going to.
Sorry,
I was just going to say, you know, obviously you want to emphasize how rare and unusual things like this are, that there are way more good people in the world than scary people like this. But do that in a careful way, again, that you're not going, oh, sure, look, you'll never meet anyone like that. Because if he believes this has happened in the locality, he's already going, you don't get it. You don't get it.
Yeah,
so just
yeah.
Medical, we know way more good people than that. And these things, thankfully, hardly ever happen.
Yeah, and I know, it probably many people who live in kind of suburban areas, you hear those rumours every now and again.
You do.
And you don't know if there's any foundation to it at all. Is it a factor? Could it be a factor that the parent does all these things, but then the 9-year-old goes back to school the next day and hears more of it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. So I think have a dedicated solution thinking time together, where every day you have a pocket of time where he's invited to bring a worry. If he has one, he doesn't have to create a worry for this. So you just call it solution time. He could bring a maths problem if he wants, because by not calling it worry time and not calling it problem time, you leave it open to, I can bring anything to this little time with you. But he can bring that there. If you're finding that your good work at home is being undermined in school, that there is this, you know, they're passing this hot potato of tension between them as a peer group in school, it's definitely worth flagging that with the school teacher, who could address it with the class at large in that solution focused way, in breaking down the myth. So if that's the case, I definitely would mention it to the school. If you think that's where the worry is gathering speed, go in there and let them know as well.
My 5-year-old son has a habit of drinking absolutely anything he sees. He seems to be perpetually thirsty. He doesn't care whose drink it is. He just grabs it and downs it. Even my husband's beer wasn't safe one evening. He drinks copious amounts of water every day and goes to bed with a 2-litre bottle that's normally empty when I go into him the next morning. Last week, my husband caught him accidentally drinking hand sanitizer that was in this squeezy bottle. We immediately brought him to A&E and he was fine. I don't understand why he does this. And after last week's incident, I'm really worried he will drink something even more dangerous and we won't be around. What do I do here?
Oh, such a worry. Like, as a parent, that's your nightmare, isn't it? They're going to ingest something they're not supposed to. So, I mean, look, if you take it just with the thirsty thing and then the drinking everything. So from a thirsty point of view, like children, young children in particular, they tend to drink a lot. I mean, 2 litres of water now overnight is a lot of water, particularly if he can go through the night and not wet the bed with that.
That's what I was thinking too.
You know, it's a lot of fluids at night. But, you know, they do tend to drink a lot and be thirstier, but it tends to correlate with it. Also, they wee a lot more than adults do. They go to the toilet much more frequently because of that. And it tends to be called at that age, you know, habitual drinking. It's part and parcel of being a child. Mm. But this is just that little bit more, you know, like 2 litres at night, that's a lot. Drinking everyone else's drink around, that kind of real impulsive behavior around fluids. Look, when you brought him to A&E and they looked at the hand sanitizer thing, I don't want to assume they did a blood test or a urine test, you know, to screen for anything beyond has he ingested something toxic or poisonous. So if they didn't, maybe go to your GP. In fact, don't maybe. If they didn't, definitely go to your GP, because that constant, seemingly insatiable thirst, it's probably worth some exploration with a blood test, a urine test, and just putting that on your GP's radar, if only to rule out that there's something, you know, medical. Mm. That might be causing this, and the poor thing can't control it. And actually, there is something else behind it. There may not be, by the way, but I'm a fan of ruling out the organic before we think about it being an emotional thing. Because then the other bit is that, you know, this isn't limited to just recognizing that's water, that's juice, that's milk, that's what I can drink. That's liquid. I'm going to drink it. And I'm wondering if there's a sensory aspect to it, because, you know, gels and sanitizers and soaps, they tend to have those kind of fluorescent colors and pinks and blues, not always, but they can be quite an attractive looking fluid for some children. So just have a little think that, is this just about what he's drinking, or is he quite sensory seeking in terms of stimulation? Does he migrate towards water, fluid, tactile exploration stuff? Again, not terribly unusual for a 5-year-old, so I don't want to pathologize that in and of itself, but just to look at, could there be a more sensory aspect to this? From a safety point of view, like okay, that's all great, I can go to the GP and look at that, but what do I do at home? I mean, it goes without saying you're going to lock up and put well out of reach any toxic or poisonous fluids in the house. Mm. But I think as well, it might be worth getting some stickers and make it a really obvious sticker, like a big star or, you know, whatever, whatever he's into, put a sticker. And you're either going to, now you decide what needs stickering, either the fluids he can drink, or put it on bottles he cannot drink. And you're saying to him, these are not for drinking, these are not safe, and you put a big sticker on them so that at a quick sight he can see, oh, that has the green sticker, I don't drink that, or that has a red sticker, I don't, whatever way you want to do it. I would definitely be marking things as safe or unsafe and putting them well out of reach, but I would want that thirst medically explored.
Yes. OK. Yeah. Because a few people are texting in speculating as to what it might be. But sure, you know, we're a radio show and we haven't met any of these people. And,
absolutely.
And we're not doctors.
I don't want to do that. Yeah.
Yes. My daughter turned 7 at the start of the month and has a real thing about everything being in its place, down to very minute detail. She says the door needs to be shut so that the hinges can be in their beds. The shoes all need to face a certain way or else they won't feel safe. No press can be opened, and she hates it when lights are left on in rooms that are empty. Even if someone plans to return to the room, she always seems to be organising and reorganising her room. Is this normal for a 7-year-old? Her behaviour is concerning me lately, as it seems to be affecting everything she does.
I mean, do you know, I don't like to get into what's normal or not normal for a 7-year-old. The bit that I'll kind of jump on is this: it seems to be affecting everything she does. That's the bit as a parent you want to respond to, because if she was doing this and happy out with her life and, you know, developing fine and getting along with everything, then I'd leave well enough alone. But if it's affecting everything she does, then yes, it's worthy of some exploration and looking at it. Children putting that kind of magical real life quality onto inanimate objects like door hinges or shoes, that's not unusual. They have that kind of magical, omnipotent thinking. She's still absolutely immersed in that. And there's a lot of good qualities. You know, the way they decide that something, they bestow magical thinking onto a household item and they have a whole story, and you know, the hairbrush has feelings, you shouldn't be so rough with it as you drag it through my hair, mom, or whatever it is. You know, there may be a little message for us in there in how they do that, but that in itself is not unusual at all. The need for control is probably something I'd be curious about. How long is that going on? And if it's pervasive, or does she add anything onto that, like, if I don't point my shoes this way, what might happen? Yeah. And if it's just, well, nothing happens, the shoes just like to face this way, again, I wouldn't psychopathologize that too much. But if it's something I feel an urgency about, that I need to have the doors closed and these pointing, or something terrible is going to happen, then I'd be a little bit more curious about that. What I mean by when I say I'd be curious, I mean that as a therapist, not a parent. So that would mean for me that you could bring her to see a play therapist who could explore what that need for control is, or what that belief behind that, or the need to do it, is about. But at home, in the meantime, because you might be listening going, I don't think it's that bad, and that's fine. But you could start playing some games at home where control isn't part of it. It's more of a random outcome. I'm thinking like snakes and ladders. You know, you could be flying along the board, zipping up ladders, and at the very last hurdle, the roll of a dice can send you down a snake. So I can't have a strategy. I can't control that. It's just I have to go with it and be in the moment and be uncertain with that and have the highs and lows. So those kinds of board games are really good for this, because there is that less control. But I also think introducing a bit of silly play, quite a lot of silly play, like just, you know, sticking on a song and everybody dropping what they're doing and doing wacky, silly dancing for the duration of that song, or trying on funny hats, or playing, mirroring each other's funny faces, who can pull the funniest face at each other. Getting silly would help to get her out of her head and down into the now moments. And there's, you know, letting go of that control and going with the flow. I think that kind of play could be really good for her. And another way of getting, but not just kids, everybody actually, but getting kids out of their busy heads where they may be preoccupied with this stuff, is to do a lot more sensory play, and just really investing in that. And you could do some of that sensory Play-Doh I've mentioned before at her age, where you involve her in the making of the Play-Doh. So the activity begins at that stage because the making of it is sensory, and give her a choice of food dyes to add drops in, or scented oils, or fresh herbs, whatever, sliced lemons, so that she can make and scent and color her own Play-Doh. And then maybe give, you know, put a few things in a bowl and pull out things that you each have to sculpt out of your ball of Play-Doh. So it's Play-Doh, but it's actually developmentally more in line with her age when you do it. But there's a lot of sensory benefit in that that'll get her out of her head.
Yeah. Mary says, just in reaction to that, people continue these sorts of behaviours through to adulthood all the time. Yeah. Absolutely no need to pathologise something like this. The child might just like things neat and tidy.
Absolutely. The only line that I would react to is, it seems to be affecting everything she's doing.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, like I said, if this is just a little quirk she has and actually it's not interfering with her life, leave it alone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I suppose, it's making her unhappy or distressing her in some way.
And also owning, you know, as parents, sometimes we're the ones who are distressed and worried. And when we take a step back and go, you know, actually, my child is doing OK with this. This is my worry that it might be something more. So if that's the case, do take that step back and just check in with yourself. Is this something that's really affecting her life, or that I'm worried is affecting her life?
Actually, on exactly that point, though, in relation to the first question we had about the 9-year-old anxious over a supposed attempted kidnapping, Sarah says, it's very hard to tell kids about real life dangers, I find. My kids get so anxious that I always end up doing what Joanna said not to do and minimising it. I know I shouldn't, but it really is hard, because I suppose in a way the parent's trying to comfort themselves as much in it, because it's probably even more terrifying for the parent.
Oh, totally. And sometimes kids are just really good at questions. Do you know, like, so when you open something up and you think, yeah, I have to, I know my discussion points, I know where I'm going with this, you know, a nine-year-old can why, but if you into such a corner that you go, oh, I've no way out of this. I'm just going to say, do you know what? It'll never happen. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And it's a way of getting ourselves out of that uncomfortable corner. But instead, if we can say, gosh, you've got really good questions that I hadn't thought about before we started this conversation, I'm going to think about your questions and come back to you to finish this when I have some more answers for you, because those are great questions. That buys you a bit of time and also communicates that as a parent, we don't have all the answers and we're okay with that.
Yeah. We do have to take a break. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. After that, a six-year-old who's very sad. 53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. Joanna Fortune is still with us for our parenting slot. Just going back to the... yeah, that nine-year-old that was anxious over when they heard a story about a local kidnapping. Pat says, unlikely is the magic word here. We shouldn't be afraid to tell children these things are really unlikely to happen rather than saying it won't happen. In fact, if we could start using the term unlikely rather than stating opinions and things definitively, we'd all be better equipped to deal with the world, with the things the world throws us, at us, says Pat. That might be better for adults. I don't know, does that necessarily work for kids, given if you say maybe to a child, they think yes?
Absolutely. And, you know, the like in one way, that's so pragmatic and it makes a lot of sense. And in another way, we have to realize that fear is irrational and it doesn't come from the part of our brain with that reasoning thinking of, oh, sure, on the balance of probability, it's unlikely. When I'm in the middle of that fear, all I'm thinking is I'm right to feel the way that I am. And I'll try to seek out evidence and I'll what if my way into, but this could happen and that could happen, because fear isn't rational. So, you know, I get it. But at the same time, that doesn't always work. And definitely not with children.
Right. The next question is this. I have a very happy and sporty little six-year-old girl. She absolutely loves school and is thriving. However, she's very sensitive. She will cry from time to time after saying goodbye to her dad in the morning as he works long hours and she doesn't get to see him every evening. More recently, she has started to cry at the thought of something sad. Not Disney movies, but real-world problems. For example, if a sad subject is brought up, like the death of a family member or the potential extinction of a wild animal or environmental issues, these can trigger her to feel very sad and cry. She will just sob to herself, never trying to make a fuss. This has been happening more frequently and has happened in school enough times for the teacher to mention it to me. When I ask her why she feels so sad, she says, I've a strong heart and I feel it in my heart. I want to support her to manage these intense feelings and also not to take on problems and world worries that are not hers and far too heavy for her little shoulders to carry.
Oh, but isn't she wise, though? You know, I have a strong heart and I feel it in my heart. And she's right. You know, she's feeling things at that amplified too much level. And of course, you're worried about that. But what she's clearly expressing is that's just the way my feelings work. You know, I have very strong feelings about this stuff. And crying with context is OK. Like, we can think, oh, crying, it's a problem. I don't want her crying. But crying is just a release of emotion. So there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. It's the fact that, you know, if it's affecting her in school or if she's not able to contain it or manage it or break things down. Now, she's only six, so she's still very much in the developmental age of co-regulating emotions with the adults around her rather than self-regulating. Mm. You might find in a few years, you know, 2 to 3 years from now, that she's still sensitive, but way better able to cope with those rushes of emotion that at the moment are overwhelming her and that are coming out. But she is able to speak about them and recognize them. And I think that's a really positive thing. There's a couple of very practical things that you could do, though. There's a book for children called The Big Bag of Worries. And it's a nice book that talks about, you know, like this, there's this little girl and she worries about something and then something else and something else. And then she's looking around her and she begins to take on the worries of others. And it's like she's lugging them around with her in a big bag. But the bigger the bag gets, the heavier it is. And she trips over it and she forgets other things and it's interfering with her life. And then, you know, there's the symbol of the wise old neighbor. And she helps her to understand that you have to take the worries out one at a time and look at them and say, what's my worry? What's someone else's worry? What's a worry that everybody has? And what's a worry that can be fixed? And to make them manageable. So you could read that story together. And then a little exercise that I like to do around that is to take empty egg carton boxes and some pipe cleaners. And if when you see the book, you'll know that they look like little gremlin-y, monstery things, the worries. And you can make worries out of those, cut out the little round bits of the egg carton and insert the pipe cleaners and make little shapes. And as you make the worries, have her name them and talk about the things that she worries about or has strong feelings about. And then you can put them all in a bag and then take them out one at a time. You know, when you're having a little time to think about worries together, so she's not thinking about them all day, but she knows there is a part of the day when you can do that. You could also get a shoebox and fashion it into something that looks like a post box, and she can post her worries in there and you take them out one at a time and break them down in manageable ways. So just kind of practical ways to do that. Don't, again, we've got quite a few worried kids today, so don't minimize what she's worried about. Don't dismiss, that's nothing to be sad about, that's nothing to cry about, because actually that's how you might feel about it. How she feels about it is, it's very much something to cry about. Around the separation with her dad, and because he's working long hours and she's sad she won't see him later, try to ensure that, you know, if you're not already, there is a video call for them to check in after school so she can share parts of her day with him. Maybe the bit that, you know, went the best and the bit she wished she could change. And something like a transitional object, like a little key ring or a little something that belongs to him that she can hang on to and return to him when they are back together. As a parent, there's a couple of books that you might find interesting from a parenting perspective. One is called The Highly Sensitive Child. It's by the woman that wrote a very well-known book called The Highly Sensitive Person. So this is one about parenting highly sensitive children. Elaine Aron is her name. And a second one that actually Elaine Aron writes a foreword for, but it's written by James Williams, is Understanding the Highly Sensitive Child. So those can be two helpful books, not to change her, but to inform how you parent and respond to her high emotional sensitivity.
Yeah, she's, God save us tonight. Sounds like, you know, she's a lot to kind of have to deal with at such a young age, really. Oh, the poor thing.
Oh, yeah. And she's just feeling things at that amplified too much level. And it's really hard to be a sensitive child because you do feel things in that kind of really loud sense that the rest of us go, oh, sure, look, it's not a big deal. But to me, it is a big deal. Mm-hmm. So I have to be validated within that, but just supported in managing it.
I have a 2.5-year-old boy and a 6-month-old baby. My 2.5-year-old was never great at playing by himself, and in the past couple of months, it has got worse. He will not play by himself at all. I give him lots of one-to-one time. He has lots of toys, but still he won't entertain himself for more than 2 minutes. I can't get anything done, and it is hard to give the baby any attention as my son is so demanding of my time. He isn't jealous of his brother at all, quite the opposite. I've tried rotating his toys so he doesn't get bored, but it hasn't helped. Is there anything I can do to help?
Yeah, I mean, there is. And then I'm going to start by saying, look, you have to manage your expectations because he's still only 2. And the older a child is, the longer they can play alone. At 2 years old, really, you're looking at 20 to 30 minutes as an optimum. OK, like on a good day, that would be typical before they need to come and check with you, because small children do that. They have to keep coming. Are you still there? Are you available to me? They just come and check in with you. I would look at it first with him, because you're starting at 2 years old with this, that can he play close by to you so that he can self-entertain and do his own little bits, but you're maybe in the room pottering around him or do whatever you're doing, that he can be around you? Or can you involve him in a playful way in the jobs you're doing? So, for example, if you're cooking dinner, put all the veggie peelings in a bowl, as I've mentioned before, and he can mess with that and play with that. Lovely sensory play, and he's right there with you, but you're still getting what you need to get done. Equally, you could give him a big towel and a little bag or basket of clothes pegs, and he could busy himself clipping the clothes pegs all around the edge of the towel while you're getting laundry done or whatever else, and he could self-entertain with that. And that's also just really good for his motor skills. So taking something away from classic toys can be really engaging for kids at this age. You know, items like I just mentioned, the vegetable peelings or the clothes pegs, but also things like spoons, cups, bowls. They can be, you know, multidimensional for children and encourage creative exploration. And, you know, I might have a huge big box of cars or Legos or dinosaurs in there, but oh my goodness, have you seen the cutlery drawer? That'll entertain me in a way those other things wouldn't. So make use of things like that. In general, when you're trying to encourage children to play independently, the advice would be to start young. Start with, you know, when they're even younger than 2 and 5 10-minute bursts of play and build that up with them. Be available to them, though, as well. Make sure you have that 15-minute window where you're not distracted by the baby or anything else and you're 100% available to him, because then he's going to be less, if he can predict with certainty that he's going to have that dedicated time with you, it'll be easier for him to tolerate you going off and doing other things, because he's safe in the knowledge you're definitely coming in to play with me for our special time together. And praise his efforts in exploring play. Gosh, look at what you did. You spent ages getting those clothes pegs around the edge of the towel, and I can see you put all the blue ones together and all the green ones together. So you get really into the effort he's put in, so that actually he does more of that type of play to elicit the same kind of very specific praise from you. The key is that you don't play for him, but you set up a little bit of play or set up a task for him. So you can use the household items, but also with his own toy selection, things like blocks or, you know, those, I'm going to call them magnet tiles, but I'm sure there's loads of versions of those magnetic-y things that stick together. Or a basket of old clothes, pieces of material that he can just swish around and try on and play with and explore. And especially if they're in a box or a basket, because he can also, at 2 years old, have the joy of climbing into that basket and out of it and emptying it and filling it up. All of that type of containment play is likely to occupy him for longer than something very kind of specific, such as play with that one thing over there, or turn that on off button on that noisy whirry thing. You want things that are quite general and allow him to project onto the item rather than the item deciding how he plays with it.
Yeah. Now, I mean, she did say he's not jealous of his brother, but maybe is there an awareness that mommy only has so much time, and so he's kind of in a marketplace for attention.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way to put it, because it's lovely he's not jealous of his brother, but he might miss the time that was once all his that he now has to share with a brother. So it's not that I'm jealous of my brother, but I miss that time. So that's why I think that the dedicated time with him, however you work that out in your day, look, ideally it would be a chunk of unbroken time, but, you know, in a busy family, maybe you're getting 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it is, make sure that you're 100% engaged with him for that time. And it may be when, you know, your co-parent is there that they take the baby so that you have that time with him. I just think that's really important. If I'm missing time, time will actually really help.
Joanna, thanks very much for speaking with us today. Joanna Fortune, there you are, listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break. After that, can Iran and the US ever be friends?
Moncrief on News Talk.